Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the media blackout in China of the 50th anniversary of Mao's Cultural Revolution that is not being observed, even though China's leader Xi Jinping's father was purged and Xi himself was sent down to the countryside for re-education. Scott Kennedy, the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the author of The Dragon's Learning Curve, Global Governance and China, joins us to discuss the apparent paradox that in spite of what the Xi family suffered and the destruction of the Chinese economy, its culture and heritage wrought by Mao's unleashing of the ideological madness of the Red Guards, China's leader is bringing back Mao and whitewashing history. Then we'll take a further look at the apparent lack of interest in the press as evidence grows from declassified documents from the 9/11 Commission of Saudi Arabia's possible involvement in 9/11 that little to no attention has been paid to in spite of the trauma of 9/11 and the trillions spent on security since. Ali Alamed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs, joins us to discuss the powerful influence of Saudi money in Washington that has succeeded in portraying Saudi Arabia as an indispensable ally, even though much of the instability in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, and Nigeria can be traced to Saudi-financed sectarian hatred and extremist religious ideology. Then finally, we'll speak with Ali Abdellatif Ahmida, a professor of political science at the University of New England and author of The Making of Modern Libya. He joins us to discuss the decision to arm the UN-backed Libyan government following talks in Vienna, even though Prime Minister Sarraj's government in Tripoli does not control the west of the country, which is under the control of General Haftar, who is supported by Egypt and the United Arab Emirates. We'll assess the chances that the new government has of defeating the Islamic State, which has a strong foothold in this chaotic country with over 1,500 competing militias. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's the author of The Business of Lobbying in China and the editor of three books, including Beyond the Middle Kingdom, Comparative Perspectives on China's Capitalist Transformation, and The Dragon's Learning Curve, Global Governance and China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Happy to be here.
And Scott, what do you make of this extraordinary silence in China over the 50th anniversary of the Cultural Revolution, particularly given that it had to be such an important part of the new president Xi Jinping's life? His father was persecuted and he himself, as a young man, was sent down to the country for re-education. And yet it's the paradox seems to be that Xi is acting more like Mao than ever, and you'd think that the experience of the family and the Cultural Revolution would be such that they'd want to get past that and forget it.
Sure. It's an important anniversary for China, but it's also highly sensitive. The main culprit of launching the Cultural Revolution is Mao, who founded the PRC, is responsible largely for their victory over the KMT and the liberation of China from foreign imperial powers. And so the verdict on him is quite mixed because of the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward, where, you know, millions died. And so the China has had a very difficult time flat out saying that the Cultural Revolution and much of the Mao era was wrong. And given the level of economic inequality now, the complexity of life, a lot of social problems that exist, the corruption, the Cultural Revolution actually in some ways is looked upon as fondly, even though the actual life experience of most Chinese, including Xi Jinping's family, was utterly horrible.
So given that there's a black hole, does that mean that the younger generation, because this was, we're talking about from 1966 to 1977, roughly, the country just fell into an abyss of dysfunction, and the young people just were set loose upon the older generation. People were stripped out of their property. They were called landlords. They were beaten, humiliated, killed. Millions died. And all of the intellectuals are the ones that they purged. That was the target. And, you know, the country just literally fell apart. So, in other words, this black hole in history, has it already affected this situation? Do the young people simply not know about their own history?
Yeah, I would say that in some ways there's a national amnesia about the Cultural Revolution, but intentional. It's certainly not just something that has naturally occurred. And it's in large part because it was such a devastating period with a lot of suffering and an experience that they didn't want to repeat. And in addition, trying to maintain the legitimacy of the Communist Party, which was responsible under Mao's hand for carrying it out. And so it's you know, other countries that have dealt with or faced this type of national level problem, like South Africa with apartheid, Germany with the Holocaust. These are Japan with its activities pre-World War II and during World War II, its level of aggression. These are very sensitive, very difficult things to do, and countries handle them in different ways that struggle. And so I'm not surprised that it is something that is very difficult to deal with. There was a period right after the end of the Cultural Revolution where you saw a bunch of literature movies and documentaries, but that was quickly closed down, and we've not seen the level of conversation about it since then. There's some private museums that deal with contemporary Chinese history that talk about the Cultural Revolution to some extent, but in official museums and textbooks, it's a very short level of cursory discussion.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Kennedy, who's the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he's the author of The Dragon's Learning Curve, Global Governance and China. So, in other words, the period just following the Cultural Revolution, where Deng Xiaoping came to power, and there was a little opening there, a little bit of explanation of what happened. I mean, after all, Deng Xiaoping's own son was tossed out of a sixth-story window by the Red Guards and became a paraplegic, you know. So it's not like he wasn't closely affected. That simply wasn't sufficient, that period, and they just decided to sort of bury it and move on?
Essentially, privately and beyond China, there's a lot of discussion and analysis, but within China, in public discourse, the Cultural Revolution is a time which is not discussed or publicly analyzed very much. There is a lot of scholarly research carried on outside China by historians. There's new archival materials available that people have looked at and have new interpretations of this period, which was not just simply, you know, an effort by Mao to avoid a revisionist path that he thought the Soviet Union had taken through Khrushchev, which he was going to make sure that China didn't. It was in some ways a power struggle between Mao and other leaders, and to some extent just a vicious political fight across the country for some, oftentimes for reasons having nothing to do with whether one side was more capitalist or socialist than the other, since by that time China's capitalist elements had really already been eliminated and it already was a state socialist system. But the public conversation in China is extremely quiet on the Cultural Revolution, and, you know, I think most folks would think a healthy conversation would be important because you want to avoid the repetition of things like the Cultural Revolution and those type of mass campaigns and the devastation that they would cause.
Well, of course, after the after Mao's death, his widow, the actress Shang Qing, she was arrested along with other members of the so-called Gang of Four, and they took the fall for it, in effect, for the Cultural Revolution. And one of the bizarre stories that come out of it is that basically that the kind of firebrand actress decided to start the Cultural Revolution in order to win win back Mao's favor? I mean, what are you to believe?
She was certainly an extremely ambitious person, Jiang Qing, Mao's, I believe, his third wife. And but I wouldn't give her that much credit, and I wouldn't give the Gang of Four that was arrested following Mao's death, put on trial, put to prison, the full blame for the Cultural Revolution either. It's really Mao gets a lot of, should get the vast majority of the blame. But in addition, this was a nationwide movement with where a lot of hands were involved. A lot of the activities that took place in specific schools, factories, provinces, local governments, really, Mao just sort of gave them license, but the actual battles, the violence, that wasn't really, you know, shouldn't be, everybody in some ways deserves their a share of the responsibility. And that makes it another difficult thing to discuss because it actually revolves saying that this wasn't a historical period that's over and the bad guys and women are gone. Actually, everyone, many of the people are still amongst us. And it's something, and so that makes it even doubly hard to directly face.
Well, it's pretty clear that the more you talk about what happened, the more you are puzzled by what is going on with the current president, whose father was a famous war hero and general, and he was accused of treason, and she himself, as a young, I guess he was a teenager, he was sent off into the countryside to get re-educated. Do we know what his personal feelings are about it? Because it's rather than turn away from Mao and recognize the insanity of ideology, I mean, some of the stuff that went on, the destruction of cultural artifacts, is similar to the insanity that's going on in Syria with and Iraq with the Daesh, the Islamic State. Although they're motivated by religious zeal. In this case, it was some peculiar communist zeal. But nevertheless, you just have to, it's quite a puzzlement, isn't it, to figure out what is she up to, do you think, bringing back Mao? Yeah.
Yes, well, I think he's divided on this. Certainly, the attack on traditional culture, the values that made China relatively strong and unified and able and be such an important society for so many years is something that she hasn't accepted. And certainly the attacks on that, the suffering of China's economy and its standing internationally that it took as a result of the problems in the Cultural Revolution and China's estrangement from a lot of the international community are certainly not things that she accepts. But in some ways, you know, she thinks like Deng Xiaoping in terms of the type of economic policies and foreign policies that China wants, but in other ways acts more like Mao. So there's some things that he's appreciating and appropriating. Certainly, the centralization of power in a single person's hands is quite distinctive comparing Xi to the other recent Chinese leaders, the attention to propaganda and the use of the propaganda apparatus, again, turned up on steroids now in China, and then also the use of political campaigns like the anti-corruption campaign, a governing technique that Mao used, developed from Stalin, and that we're seeing now quite common in a variety of different ways. So there's the one thing that he definitely is not doing is bringing the entire population, mobilizing them for political activity. He has, in fact, gone the entire opposite way and trying to remove Chinese citizens from direct involvement in politics because from their perspective, that would be quite dangerous. So in many ways, Xi Jinping is a populist, but he's a populist who doesn't want the population to be active in politics because of the danger that might bring.
But his corruption purge to go after the tigers and the flies has been sort of selective, shall we say, given that the Panama Papers indicated that his own family had been squirreling away billions. And that seems to be a very strange kind of barometer for China. What's going on with all of the business elites and the rich? Are all money is pouring out. I believe trillion is poured out this year. That's going out with their kids. They're moving, buying property. They're driving up property in Vancouver, or Sydney, Australia, you name it. And at the same time, this is almost like, you know, they're almost sort of running away from another revolution, not a cultural revolution, but some kind of, you know, atavistic Maoist revolution to bring back the power of the party. So at the end of the day, doesn't this indicate that, because one of the things that Kissinger pointed out when he was chaired a big meeting recently in Shanghai was he was afraid that this government could, with its economic problems, resort to military Keynesianism. And, you know, if they go that path, our side will jump in, because we have obviously the neocons and the military-industrial complex would be only too happy to oblige. So I'm trying to sort of draw a picture of two paths here that aren't running in parallel, that are running in parallel, but at some point one could take over the other.
I suppose it could possibly. You know, my sense is that when Xi Jinping came into power, he saw that the previous leadership led by Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao was politically weak, had allowed corruption to run rampant, had a poor economy, weak foreign policy, and Xi Jinping was going to fix that by centralizing power, having a massive anti-corruption campaign, having a more assertive foreign policy, and he's lived up to that. And, you know, in many ways, yes, the anti-corruption campaign is been selective in the type of targets at the very top that it's picked and those who it hasn't targeted. But after having arrested or kicked out of the party over 100,000 people, it seems, this isn't you can't do factional politics at that scale. And so some of it is certainly about elite infighting, and a lot of it is also about just trying to reduce the level of corruption. Even though it's not about installing Western-style rule of law, it's about cutting back corruption the way we cut our lawn and get rid of weeds. So you cut it down, and hopefully it grows back more slowly. And if possible, I think that's their approach. I think Chinese businesses, those connected to the political elite, and those that aren't, are quite anxious about China, both because of the political environment where property rights, you could say, aren't very stable, and the economic future is somewhat ambiguous because of the declining growth and the burgeoning debt and some of the volatility that we saw in the stock market and foreign exchange markets last year and the beginning of this year. So that has led Chinese to hedge their bets. To move some money abroad, to look for other investment opportunities. But I don't think we ought to go too far and say that Chinese have already decided that China is too unstable, that it's heading back to the Cultural Revolution and it's a place where someone can't do business. I think they would like it to work out. China's definitely walking a very fine line in trying to figure out how to liberalize their economy, deal with the corruption problems, and keep growth going. And not do it in a way that riles up foreign powers in a way that brings much more attention to China. So I think they're making some mistakes along the way that bring the problems on themselves. But I think even if they were making all the right decisions, it still wouldn't be an easy path for them.
Well, we'll stay in touch. And it sounds like Big Daddy Xi, as he's now likes to be known as, has got a lot on his plate.
Yes, he certainly does, and the challenge that the Cultural Revolution presents doesn't make it any easier.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Scott Kennedy.
Good talking to you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy, who's a Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. His latest book is The Dragon's Learning Curve, Global Governance and China. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with a further look at the apparent lack of interest in the press as evidence grows of Saudi involvement in 9/11. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ali Alamed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs, and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family history. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Alamed.
Thank you for having me.
And obviously with this growing pressure on President Obama to declassify the 28 pages, I find it extraordinary that a lot of the inquiry and the methodology of the inquiry on the part of the 9/11 Commission staff was just recently declassified, well, about a year ago, and it basically has got very little attention until former New York Times reporter Phil Sheehan mentioned them in an article in The Guardian. And again, it's The Guardian, a British newspaper, that seems to be taking the lead on this extraordinarily important story. I would have thought that if the Saudi Arabians or some elements in the Saudi Arabian government were involved in 9/11, which was the most traumatic event in modern American history, that the U.S. press would be paying some attention to it.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. But we are currently in the United States, the media, because of several reasons, because of the economic decline and the decline of the revenues, for example, you mentioned the New York Times. The New York Times had to sell its building to survive. So you are looking at the financial problem that faced by media in general. Secondly, the media companies or journalism companies in the United States have basically evaporated in favor of media companies, which are profit-driven and ideologically driven. So you have these two reasons, I think, that blocked paying attention. It's very selective in terms of where you write the stories and the way you write it. The New York Times included, the Washington Post included, they would not touch certain issues because they don't want to embarrass the administration or certain foreign governments. And that we have seen that. I have seen that myself many times in Washington. And I think that is why The Guardian, give them credit, they are the one who are one of the most, actually, freest newspapers in the world in terms of their capacity to address issues that are sometimes risque in the United States, even for the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Well, I can understand in terms of Fox News, because Rupert Murdoch's the second biggest stakeholder in Murdoch's companies, News Corp, etc., apart from the Murdoch family, is the Kingdom Fund of Saudi Arabia. So you can understand why Fox News and Murdoch's papers are hostile to global warming and would probably cover up anything involving negative publicity for Saudi Arabia. But
Yes, absolutely. Yesterday, just on Friday, the Al-Waleed bin Talal met with Murdoch and with the CEO of Twitter. Twitter is also one of those companies that have basically been shielding the Saudi monarchy from criticism and using its power to do that.
And why would they do that? I mean, is it just purely money?
Because it's money. Money. It's, like I said, that's the distinction between journalism and media companies. And the media companies are profit-driven, like the Murdoch, the Disneys, and the other, in Twitter, including Twitter and Facebook, both are they are driven. I mean, I can tell you, YouTube, for example, have taken down the videos of a famous Saudi critic, satire, political satirist, many times because he criticized the ruling family. That's the only thing. They blocked him from using YouTube.
But what if it turns out, we know that King Salman, even though he's mentally impaired and his son, the deputy crown prince, is running the kingdom, he's considered one of the most hardcore Wahhabis. And it may well end up that the ultimate financing for 9/11 could well lead back to him. We know it was done through the Department of Islamic Affairs, which is the sort of cutout part of the Saudi government that deals with the so-called Wahhabi spread around the world. So my sense is that if the Saudis really did this, and there's certainly growing evidence that they were involved, you would think that they must think we're the biggest bunch of idiots on the planet. And the fact that we keep covering up for them is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, it is true. You know, forget if they were involved or not. Just fact that there is a possibility that they involved, that they were involved, even by neglect, by way of neglect. This should have been an issue. The United States government should have said, "Look, we have doubts. We need to know. Let us meet these people. Let us interview those individuals that might be involved." That did not happen. The United States government did not even pursue or ask to interview or interrogate individuals who were named in these 28 pages or other people or and organizations who might have been involved. I mean, that, for that crime this big, you want to know, you want to investigate every possible link. The United States government, I'm talking about the White House, the State Department, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, all of those people did not entertain the idea of asking the Saudi government for permission or for support in investigating Saudi nationals who were in Saudi Arabia. Some of them were actually in the United States to interview them to see if they know about this. That is really the problem. Here you see a case where an absolute monarchy has that kind of influence over the United States after a crime of the history of this history has been committed in the United States, and the United States officials are unable and unwilling to even request or put a request in for questioning people because they happen to be Saudi nationals.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Alamed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al-Saud family history. And of course, from these declassified reports that were quietly declassified by the National Archives about a year ago, and nobody except, again, Phil Sheehan and The Guardian seem to have picked up on them. And if the stuff in these papers is so extraordinary to my mind that you have to think, my God, if this is being declassified, what could possibly be in the 28 pages that's even more incriminating? But they are, you know, they did, 9/11 Commission staff did go to Saudi Arabia and interviewed this Fahad Al-Thumari, who was the diplomat out here at the Los Angeles Consul, who met with the other conspirators, including the two hijackers who flew into the Pentagon, Al-Hazmi and Al-Midah. And the extraordinary thing is, of course, that when they interviewed this guy, as soon as they pressed him, he just completely went hysterical. And the staff thought he was as guilty as sin. But the amazing thing is, not only was this guy the accredited Saudi diplomat here in Los Angeles, he was also the imam of the King Fahd Mosque in Culver City, California, which is a Wahhabi mosque. So here, to my mind, there you have it. I mean, here you got a guy that gets booted out of the country because of his ties to Al-Qaeda, and he's the imam of this mosque that's spreading this version of Islam, which has radicalized so much of the Islamic world.
Yes. They might interviewed. They have interviewed one individual. They have not interviewed, for example, the recruiter, or not even talked about the recruiter of the September 11 hijackers. And I think I mentioned that to you in the pre-interview that this man, his name is Sheikh Ahmed Al-Hawashi, is still alive, and he receives royal stipend every month. And there are pictures of him with the Saudi princes and even the son of the Saudi king, King Abdullah, and he is the one who recruited 9 of the 15 Saudi September 11 hijackers. So he was involved in the United States. If you recruit somebody to do something and they do something, you are responsible. This guy is still alive, has not spent a day, an hour in jail, has never been interrogated or asked about his role into this. I worked with an Australian reporter years ago on this story, and he went to that city and did a very good story, and it's available online. And yet the U.S. government did not entertain the idea that is, let us open, let us see that network. How did these Saudis go to Afghanistan and then come to the United States? There is a network that's still in operation in Saudi Arabia, and the United States government has never raised this issue with the Saudis. Otherwise, this man would be in jail, like the protesters who have been shot by the Saudi police. This guy is still alive, and he's still free, and that's really what my bone to pick with the U.S. government, that they have ignored the victims of September 11 to protect the sensitivity of the Saudi monarchy. And that is really very, very, very painful to see.
So how do we know that Sheikh al-Hawaji is the recruiter of nine of the hijackers?
Well, I know this from a local reporters who told me, and because some of these people were their relatives, and even the locals tried to kill this guy because he took many of their sons and sent them to terrorist groups. The Saudi government reaction is to protect him and to give him royal treatment. And like I said, the Sydney Morning Herald wrote a story about it and about the details of his role in the recruitment of the not only the September 11 hijackers, the majority of them, but also of others, hundreds of young men who appeared later to be suicide bombers in different countries and have killed probably tens of thousands of people. This man is still alive. The network that recruited the September 11 hijackers continues to operate in Saudi Arabia, and that's why since September 11 we have seen not 15 Saudi terrorists and suicide bombers, but 15,000 in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, Egypt, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and around the world.
So the question, of course, on the minds of most of our listeners would be, why would the Saudi government do this, particularly with these links to the current king and his son, the youngest son, the crown prince, who are hardcore Wahhabis? What would their motive be?
Well, the Saudi monarchy was founded on terrorism. The early Saudi state basically acted in the same manner that ISIS, the same ideology that ISIS is using, the same tactics that ISIS is using. So it has been very worthwhile, very beneficial for the Saudi monarchy to use proxies like ISIS and branches of Al-Qaeda, not all of Al-Qaeda, but branches of Al-Qaeda, to unleash them against their enemies without having to answer for it. And that's what they have been doing in Syria and Iraq. The ideology, the money comes from Saudi Arabia mainly, but from other Gulf countries as well. And the United States so far has not raised that issue. Like I said, it's not Iranian nationals who are blowing themselves around the Middle East. It's mostly Saudi nationals, yet the Saudi government is not on the terrorist sponsor list. It's Iran and it's Sudan and others. So that is really, it's a failure of policy. It is the failure of the Treasury Department, the FBI, the CIA, or maybe, you know, sometimes I think it's not failure. Maybe they just want, this is the way they want it, and they are willing to let this happen for some reason. I don't know if it's policy or it is corruption. I have no idea.
So when we were talking earlier, Ali Alamed, you also said that did you do some translations for the 9/11?
Yes.
So tell me about that. Yes. And
well, in 2001, when the U.S. government came out with the Osama bin Laden, many people, your listeners probably know about this, when the tape was aired and there was subtitles in the video of Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. The translation that was released by the United States government was extremely bad. So I approached several media companies, and then ABC at the time accepted my offer to do the translation, the correct one. When we did it, it was a huge story, if many people remember. And the information, the amount of information in that correct and accurate translation that I did, it was mind-boggling. It named Saudi officials, and it named all the hijackers, basically, who confirming the Osama bin Laden role into the attacks, and bringing the names of Saudi nationals who are still alive again and have never been touched or interrogated, their role into this Even it brought the name of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but his code name, he's mentioned there. And it talked about what Osama bin Laden was doing exactly at the moment when he heard the news on BBC radio. So it really tells you a lot. And I hope to release the complete transcript in the next few weeks with analysis of what's on the tape. And there is a lot of intelligence in that video that the U.S. government either ignored or were not aware, because they don't have the capable people. If one person like me was able to do what the U.S. federal government failed to do, that tells you really that this system of security and intelligence is extremely broken.
So that's the video of the Saudi visitor who comes to talk to bin Laden after 9/11. That's the one that you're talking about.
Yes.
And where he talks about how bin Laden talks about how surprised he was that it worked out so well, and how the jet fuel, poured down the mainframe and melted, and all this sort of engineering stuff that bin Laden, of course, understood, and how he thought it was just even worked out better than he expected. All of that stuff, you've done the accurate translation, and it's just full of intelligence, but the U.S. government translation that came out was totally inadequate. So do you think it's an error of commission or omission or just incompetence?
I don't know, really. Sometimes I was interviewed about that heavily, and I cannot tell. But there is a possibility that it was because of the incompetence. And I met at the time with Dr. Jamal Hilal, the top Arab interpreter slash translator for the U.S. government. He was working at the State Department, but he was several presidents, translator, an interpreter into Arabic. And he said, we couldn't understand. And I said, of course, you're an Egyptian Coptic Christian. What do you know about the colloquial language of the Arabian Peninsula? That's very hard. It's different. But they, even then, although I was on the media, everybody knew my credentials, I was never approached by the U.S. government to say, can you help us? And that tells you something, that it's they don't want to know, or they are completely incompetent. And this is somebody who I met with one of the circle. I wrote faxes. I said, I'm ready to help. And I was in the media, like I said. It was public information that this guy showed how the U.S. government failed to translate this. Yet no U.S. government agency approached me to ask me for help. And I don't know why. Is it because they were embarrassed by this? Where they had a different plan for the translation, and I kind of, without knowing, undermined it. I have no idea. But that gives you an insight of how these people think. In my experience, 15 years since September 11, there is a lot of incompetence within the intelligence world. You have young people, because they come from certain background, they are the one who is supposed to decide and analyze, yet they cannot differentiate between two countries or two states or two sects or two groups in the Middle East, because just that they don't have the experience. They can't. Going to Harvard does not make you an expert. Actually living and having the experience makes you an expert. But graduating from Harvard or Stanford is not enough credential to make you an intelligence expert and linguistic expert.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it. And when you finish this translation, let me know about it. I'd like to disseminate it as much as possible.
I wanted to say that something that you notice that although 15 of the 19 September 11 hijackers were Saudi nationals, the Saudi government has never expressed regret or an apology for their national, for 15 Saudi being involved in this terrorist attack and many, many other terrorist attacks around the world.
Well, again, I've been speaking with Ali Alamed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al-Saud family history. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the decision to arm the UN-backed Libyan government. Dun, dun, dun. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ali Abdellatif Hamida, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He's the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya, and Post-Orientalism, Critical Reviews in North African Social and Cultural History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Abdellatif Hamida.
And thank you, Ian, and it's a pleasure to be with you again, except that I have to remind you that I'm saved and I'm no longer the chair.
Oh, what is your role then? I'll do that again.
I am a professor. I'm a professor of political science.
All right. Let me do that again.
Okay.
And joining us now is Professor Ali. And joining us now is Ali Abdellatif, who's professor of political science at the University of New England. Okay, we'll cut that in.
So
the conference underway that's just finished up in Vienna, chaired by Secretary of State Kerry and the Italian foreign minister, I guess the headlines coming out of it are that there's this UN-recognized government of Fayez al-Sarraj. The UN has lifted the arms embargo to have this government accept arms, I imagine, from Europe and the US. But the other part of it that's a bit strange is that there's sort of two governments. There's one in the east under General Haftar, and it's recognized by the Egyptian government and the United Arab Emirates, and apparently there's been some pressure on them to sort of force General Haftar, who's the military leader of the eastern part of the country, to work with this new government. So it's a bit odd to be arming a government when you've got a separate government there. And my understanding is that Russia is prepared to start printing currency for this separate government in the east of General Haftar's, which is only going to complicate matters further.
Yes, indeed. And I think your reading of it is correct. The problem is Libya, after the fall of the old Gaddafi's regime, went through a couple of years of very positive steps toward transition to establish a new form of government and new institutions and also elections. And the Libyan people voted three times in a peaceful, very, very positive they elected the people Congress, they elected the Constitutional Assembly, and also the House of Representatives of the Libyan Parliament. So that's happened earlier, but then after that, the armed groups and the militias inside each region, and also, unfortunately, the Obama administration's and the European community failure to lead the Libyan, a transition or help Libya establish a more stable form of government led to regional powers ranging from the neighbors to countries like Turkey, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, other countries to intervene and support different factions. And Libya went through fragmentation and a de facto civil war. As a matter of fact, Ian, there are three governments now. There is the old national government supported one. There is the new Fayez Sarraj based government that's supported by the United States and also the European Community. And there is also the parliament government, placed in eastern region of Libya and the city of Tobruk. So it's a very, very fragmented scene. And a country also awash with many guns and many, many weapons. And it's very odd that the announcement supported the Fayez Sarraj government without really dealing with the fact that the eastern region has a different government, different army, and also a different parliament that's split right now. So your reading is correct. This is not going to resolve the problem. This is might perpetuate the tension and the civil war there.
Well, there's also a third power center, if you will, down in the south, formerly the stronghold of Gaddafi, and that's Sirte, and that's where the Islamic State seems to have a lot of influence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's correct. The now, seemingly, they are agreed, or they are, these factions and these groups, regional groups, are agreed on fighting the threat of ISIS or Daesh in Sirte. And we, the listeners need to know that the fact that, you know, the vacuum in Libya after the fall of the old regime led to the rising of many groups. And in the city of Derna in the eastern region and the city of Sirte, the extremist groups, whether that Al-Qaeda branch there or, you know, ISIS, took over the city of Sirte in central Libya. And that group, which is, we know that they have around between 5,000 to 6,000 fighters, most of them are from outside Libya. And they began to expand to Abu Ghraib in to the east, and to even to the region of Jufra, where I was born and where some members of my family live. So Daesh or ISIS pose a threat to all of them, but also pose a threat to the European security in general. And I think that's why the European powers are very, very nervous about what goes on in Libya.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Abdellatif, a professor of political science at the University of New England and the author of The Making of Modern Libya. Well, there are other concerns, of course, that the UN have and the European powers and the United States, which were made clear at this conference. And that is they want to stop the people smuggling. They want to beef up the Libyan Coast Guard. They also don't want the chaos in Libya to spill over in Tunisia, which is a fragile but fairly successful democratic experiment in the region, given what little success, if you will, has come from the so-called Arab Spring. So there's a lot at stake. And as you say, the, you know, after the intervention to get rid of Gaddafi, it looks as if everybody sort of walked away. My understanding is, though, that there are the Italians, the British, the French, and the United States have special forces groups in there. So what's your understanding of where things are in terms of the fighting the Islamic State or Daesh, given how difficult it's been to get rid of Daesh in both Iraq and Syria? They're pretty tenacious, and they seem to have a pretty strong foothold in Libya.
Well, they came to Libya because there was a vacuum, but also as a consequence of the pressure was put on ISIS in Syria and Iraq. So many of the fighters found refuge there. And one scenario of you know, which is, that's why Libya is very significant in this larger global politics. If as we are now knowing the situation in Syria and Iraq, is getting really tense, and Daesh or ISIS is losing ground, then Libya, unfortunately, might be the other area where they might regroup, especially if we know there are other groups in southern Algeria, Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, and they might have alliance there to find in the vacuum in Libya a place to expand and wage a different kind of, you know, war in northern Africa. The problem, the way I see it, is Daesh is real, and especially Libya doesn't have a central army, central government, and that allows 6,000 fighters to really control that region. And you could imagine, Ian, if there are 20,000 fighters, very tenacious, very, very vicious, then they could really cause a tremendous havoc. However, on the other hand, this announcement by the 20 ministers in Vienna now is really myopic and limited, and it's not going to solve the problem. What needed, Ian, in this conference is to try to find a way to include the parliament in eastern Libya, to also even General Haftar, who's a very controversial figure, but in eastern Libya has a lot of support, to see a role for him and not to exclude him completely, especially we know that the Sarraj government and the agreement that was made in Morocco included hardcore Islamists and the Libyan Fighting Group and the Muslim Brothers and others who are still operating in eastern Libya and western Libya. So in that sense, only by trying to reach to the eastern region and trying to bring people together, there will be might be an exit from this impasse. But to arm the government in western Libya and assume that is going to resolve the problem in Libya, that's really wishful thinking.
But just to figure a way to bring the government in Tobruk together with the government in Tripoli, the one in the west and the one in the east, the eastern one led by General Haftar, both of them had squabbles over oil and oil terminals on the Mediterranean.
Yes.
So you'd
yes.
think that there would be a common interest here, which is, you know, you guys should stop fighting. We should secure the oil fields. That's our main source of revenue, and share it equitably. I mean, who is anybody brokering talks here between these two sides?
Yeah, well, there was a dialogue committee. Unfortunately, I have to say that the leaders that, you know, led the transition in Libya after the fall of the Gaddafi regime did not really failed miserably in looking beyond their own interests. And I have to say, no really competent, wise figures emerged, you know, since the first 2 years to really try to bring people together. And that vacuum of leadership persists until today. The second problem, Ian, is the fact there is a political economy of that perpetuates the continuing of this conflict. Many young men and many young men who are 18 or 20 or 21 and with high school diploma or so, they have salary, they have guns, they have prestige, they have influence, and they really control oppositions. So that become really seductive to many of these armed groups, and we're talking about almost 1,500, you know, 1,500 small group, and they really control money, they control positions, they control salaries, and they have tremendous influence. So I think that became a problem. There was an attempt to arm and create a Libyan army, and they were trained in Jordan, and they were trained, some of them, in England and other places, and it failed because they were not selected individually, they were selected as a group. So these armed groups, they have no interest in having a national army and a national reconciliation. On the contrary, because they feel they have power and influence, they are blocking any attempt to create those national institutions. And the prime ministers, whether that Mr. Al-Kib or Mr. Zaidan, they even added, they made the problem even more complex by giving them more salaries and more, they try to buy off their leaders, and that empowered them more. So all of these factors led to a situation where the drive for compromise and sitting together with other groups became less lucrative, if you would like to say, and that made the Libyan situation really tragic and also terrible for the ordinary Libyans who fought very hard and voted for a civilian government, and they have been waiting for all of those years. And right now, life in Libya, Ian, is terrible. I mean, I have family members and friends who they can't get their salaries for the last 4 or 5 months. They can't even cash their checks and open their accounts at the banks. The prices are outrageous and high. The Libyan dinar is really devalued so drastically, and people suffering. And those factions and those groups are still trying to cling to power. And it's really a tragedy, because Libya, as I talked to your listeners many, many times earlier over these years, could have been a model for the region. Now, because of all of those problems, Libya is a tragic situation.
And given, you said there are 1,500 of these militias, that's similar to what's happening also in Syria. And it's the concern is that they don't want another Syria, but it doesn't sound like these Vienna talks have really solved the main problems, which is
It has not. And the Libya, the problem with the Vienna talk, they say, okay, the Sarraj government is the UN approved and, you know, and blessed government. End of story. In a situation where it's de facto civil war, you can't say that. You could say what should have been said is that the Sarraj government is the best solution for now. It's not ideal, but the best solution for now. But we are going to help the Sarraj government to reach and give a goodwill hand to the other factions in the east and try to draw them in instead of saying those are warlords or these are really have they impose sanctions on them, and so in refusing to recognize or see the complexity of the Libyan situation itself. Now, on the other hand, General Haftar, who has a very, very controversial history, as I said before, he need to say to Libyans that I am for national unity, I will be willing to work with the central government, but they have also to recognize the army that I formed, my fight against the extremists, and also reach some compromises that include all the factions, including the eastern forces. That hasn't been done, and I think the idea to say, to the point that General Haftar is regarded as an outlaw, or the parliament is really completely out of the picture. That's not realistic, but also not in the spirit of inclusion. Whether you like General Haftar or not, he's a major force in the eastern region, and I think bringing him to the table is very important for having a breakthrough in the Libyan crisis.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Ali Abdellatif Ameeda.
Thank you, Ian. It has been always a pleasure to be with you and your listeners. And I hope next time when we talk, there will be a breakthrough.
I do it too. And again, I've been speaking with Ali Abdellatif Ameeda, who's a professor of political science at the University of New England. He is the author of The Making of Modern Libya. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.